The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this February 6, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. More on that later in the hour. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm pleased to be joined now. It's short stories the entire hour. As regular listeners to the show know, I'm a huge fan of the short story form. And I'm pleased to be joined now by Sarah Hall. In the second half hour, Jennifer Haig will be here with her short story collection, News from Heaven. Sarah Hall is the author of Hayeswater, which won the 2003 Commonwealth Writers Prize for Best First Novel, among other awards. In 2004, her second novel, The Electric Michelangelo, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize, the Commonwealth Writers Prize, and others. Her third novel was published in 2007, The Carhullen Army, to more awards. Her fourth novel, How to Paint a Dead Man, was published in 2009 and was long-listed for the Man Booker Prize and won the Portico Prize for Fiction in 2010. Her work has been translated into more than a dozen languages, but it is Sarah's first collection of short stories entitled The Beautiful Indifference, published by Faber & Faber in 2011 and released now in paperback by Harper Perennial that we'll chat about this morning. The Beautiful Indifference won the Portico Prize for Fiction in 2012, the Edge Hill Short Story Prize, and was also shortlisted for the Frank O'Connor Prize. My pleasure to welcome her. Sarah, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. This was a treat. I really enjoyed these stories. I want to start first by talking about your decision after four published novels to switch over to the short story form and what inspired you to switch forms, what you felt this form could do for you that perhaps the novel couldn't.
Well, I think probably like a lot of writers, I'd been collecting up short stories and writing them as I went along at the same time as writing the novels. But because the short story form is so exacting, you really want to have the best ones collected up for the first time. And I'd signed up for this collection with Faber in the UK quite a while ago, 6-7 years before I actually delivered the stories, just wanting to make sure that each and every one of them was as good as I could get it. There was a big cut made, lots of stories were left out, and really these are the seven that I felt confident about. So it's not so much either or in this country. I think you find a lot of writers writing novels and stories, but the market is not quite as big for short stories either, so they're more intermittent when they come out.
Right. Now, had you been working in the short story form all the way through, or is this sort of a new development?
I have. I actually studied the short story form and poetry, not the novel, when I was at St. Andrews University in Scotland. So really, I came to the novel in a very strange way and sort of almost taught myself how to do it. But I'd studied the short story, which may also have made me more nervous about finally publishing the collection, because you're just aware how many other fantastic short story writers there are out there and how demanding the form is.
Yeah. So I'm going to let you introduce the collection and talk about what inspired these stories themselves, if there was sort of a global area of concern in these stories, you know, if you feel like the stories are in dialogue with each other, and kind of what you're thinking behind the collection itself.
Yeah, so I suppose they are linked thematically, which again is fairly common for short story collections. And myself, I really... I've been doing a lot of traveling, and for some reason that just seemed to lend itself well to the form. So I'd signed up for the collection a long time ago, and I'd had a couple written that I thought were good. But just maybe 2-3 years ago, I was really traveling extensively. My partner was working out in South Africa at that point, and I was out there visiting him and traveling in the Northern Hemisphere and Scandinavia as well. And when you're traveling, you know, these strange episodes do happen to you, like an almost disaster with a rowing boat, which at the time you think, well, you know, your boat is slightly sinking on a lake, this would be a fantastic short story. If I can get to the shore, I must write this up. So these strange things had been happening to me for a couple of years, and it just seemed it just seemed that they were going to fit really well into the short form. I also felt like I'd been honing my skills with writing the novels, and that I'd developed a sense of structure through doing that, that perversely, strangely, seemed to work very well when I finally started writing the short stories in earnest.
Yeah. You may have already touched on this in your answer to the last question, but I'm wondering what drives your stories. It sounds like, certain life events have driven some of these, but I'm wondering if you feel like it's more character-driven, more plot-driven, more thematically driven, what kind of is the impetus behind the stories when you sit down to write them?
It's probably a perfect storm of all those elements, if I'm lucky and I feel a good short story is coming out. I'm very interested in landscape as well, obviously. The stories in the collection are set in different locations. One's in Mozambique, one's in Finland, a couple in England. So, and you really need a strong sense of place if you're going to sort of set a story out in a wilderness and have that wilderness be an important dramatic component of the story. So I'm always trying to really try and get hold of the essence of every place and transpose it onto the page, through an essential way, just to convince the reader that they are actually there in Finland in the summer, with the humidity and the meadow grasses and the eerie lake. So probably landscape is my first port of call, and then character comes along after that, very, very soon after. The short stories, I think, are a little more autobiographical than my other work. The novels feel less so. They feel like grand projects that are not so much to do with me, more an inquiry into a big subject matter. But the stories are uncomfortably so, actually, if I'm honest. They feel a little closer to things that have happened to me. Strange things that have happened to me, big, challenging things, illness, travel, and you... In order to metabolize them and come to terms with them, I think, the short story kind of gives you a small dramatic window in which to kind of look into yourself somehow, as well as looking out.
It's funny you should make the comment about landscape earlier, because one of the things that I noticed that I think you do so well, I think a lot of short story writers do so well, is to imbue the landscape or to imbue inanimate objects with some of the things that the characters are going through. Like there's this great line in She Murdered Immortal He, which is one of the stories in the collection, about, she's in this kind of jungle. I'm thinking she's in Vietnam or Cambodia or something like that, but I'm not sure.
Actually, that's Mozambique, but yeah.
Mozambique,
it could be jungle
exactly right.
Anywhere, really. And half of it is psychological. You're right. There's a kind of an element to that of psychology.
Right, right. And she had said, there's a line about all around were intimately knotted branches. And I was thinking about, kind of imbuing inanimate objects with, this intimately knotted up relationship that she's in. And I was wondering if, I've been told when you write sex scenes, sometimes imbuing the objects around the couple with sexualized language is more effective than putting it onto the couple themselves. And I was thinking you did that as well in here psychologically, to put things onto the landscape that the couple's going through.
Yeah, I think I do. And I think that's probably true of how we all are. We're very affected by the weather, and you interpret the landscape depending on what mood or state of mind you're in. And so often the characters in these stories are alone. They might be traveling with a partner, but they found themselves in a situation where they're alone and they're having to contend with the landscape. And so there is a sort of much more of a personal examination of that character's psychology, and the way that they are seeing the world is relating to how they're feeling. Again, in the Finnish story, you see this one character, there's a whole psychological drama played out in her mind, and it's never actually verified in the real world, but the way she's seeing the world is very much to do with this heightened state of anxiety that she's got herself into, worrying that her lover, who's out swimming in the lake, is drowning.
Right, right. Yeah, and I'm always intrigued by this ability to tell more truth through fiction than you can tell through nonfiction. And, your comment about how many of these stories reflect sort of your internal some struggle that you've gone through, and not being wedded to, telling the actual events of what may have happened to you, but being able to do it more effectively through fiction. I'm wondering your thoughts on that, on the ability to tell truth through fiction as opposed to truth through nonfiction.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point, and I suppose a lot of writers would say that they feel that they are somehow mining a truth when they're creating these scenarios and writing these stories. And in a way, it's conversely because you're creating an artificial environment and creating an artificial scenario, which might allow you to really examine something not too a satisfying conclusion, but just in a very thorough way. So somebody's state of mind, somebody's state of heart, you can create a very convenient scenario that has a dramatic arc, which actually will see that person through to the end of where they're going. So on the beach by the jungle in Mozambique, a woman who's been jilted by her lover, or at least he tells her he's no longer interested in her, finds herself having to very quickly process what it means to be in a breakup, and eventually she sort of kills them off romantically in her mind, and that's an accelerated process which perhaps would take much longer in real life, but for the sake of the story, you can kind of have a pocket-sized process, a mental or emotional process that somebody's going through.
Right. You are tuned into Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are on with Sarah Hall, author of The Beautiful Indifference. So talking about the revision process, I'm wondering how much your first draft of a story resembles the final draft and what that transition process looks like.
The first draft is usually fairly close to the finished draft. I think I have a tendency to discard early drafts if they don't look like they've cracked something. I've heard potters and ceramicists talk this way, that if you don't throw the lump of clay right in the first instance and kind of the mass of it doesn't somehow land right and have a good enough initial shape, then it won't work. It won't be turned into anything good. And I do feel that way about the stories. So while there might be line editing and a little bit of structural work, they generally are fairly close to how they will end up on the page, more so than the novels. And again, I don't know if that's because with a short story, it's easier to have a sense of what that structure might be before you start. So if you think you know what you're writing about and you have a scenario or an episode in mind, you can in a way see towards the end of it. And I'm not a planner when I write. I'm more of an intuitive writer. So again, with the novels, there's a lot of reworking to do because a novel is a big thing not to plan. It's a big thing to write intuitively and then go back and revise. But with the short stories, because I can sense their shape more before I start, it usually leaves me in a good position if it comes out right the first time.
Right. There always seems to be this magic moment in short stories with, you know, the twist or the small yeah. shift in the character. And I wonder if you feel like that is a learned, that magic moment is always very visible to you, and if that is a learned skill to know when that magic moment has happened, or if that's something you've kind of cultivated over the course of writing over the years.
I think it's probably a little bit of both. I mean, you're a reader before a writer usually, and you can see what other writers have been getting up to. And in a way, there are certain forms that lend themselves to certain shapes and inflections and dramatic twists and things like that. And the short story does do that very well. I mean, you know, I think round about the two-thirds mark, something often tends to slip gears, or a rug is pulled out, or there's a switchback, or some psychological disturbance. All the tension that's been building will slightly bear out, if not in a conclusive manner. Then, that wobble that's been threatening really starts to happen. And I love that. I like, as a reader, I like to be slightly disturbed and go away questioning and to have more questions being asked than answered. And the short story does do that very well. So I feel in a way that my proclivities as a writer and as a reader are suited to the short story. If you enjoy disturbing people rather than consoling them, or not disturbing them, but going towards difficult questions and disturbing the ordinary, you know, then I think that is definitely the form for you, for me.
I always wonder if that's what's causing, you know, short stories to be a harder sell, either in America or in the world in general, that, you know, Americans, I feel like their stories wrapped up in little packages with bows, you know, and they like to know how things end. And the comments that I hear from a lot of readers on short stories is, you know, I felt very unmoored by the end of it. I didn't know what the story was about. I wanted to know what happened. That unrest, I think, is uncomfortable for people.
Yeah, I wonder if that's true, and I think that certainly might be the case in Britain as well. Although, who knows, you know, what the validity of these myths about why short stories are hard to sell and hard to read are. Because you do hear very positive comments from people who enjoy reading them and want more of them, but they're just not out there.
Yeah.
But yeah, it could be that in our reading diet, we've been slightly trained towards consolation or happy ending or some sense of... you know, everything ending solvent somehow. And because the short story doesn't really lean that way successfully, I think perhaps they do have to struggle a little bit more for people who are just not used to reading that sort of thing. I don't know. I mean, it is an interesting question.
Yeah. How much is known by you as writer about the character's backstory that doesn't make it onto the page? Like, if you take a short story like The Agency, how much do you know about this woman that, you know, perhaps we don't know? Do you have an entire imagined life for her background and where she came from and her proclivities that we only get a sense of the tip of the iceberg of her?
Actually, I don't. It's probable that I've got more of a sense of the character than the reader will have, although you're always hoping to allude to those things in the story and make sure that there are enough echoes of that person going on that you see, you know, or you suspect more than the interaction is showing you. And I think it's Catherine Mansfield that said, wasn't it, that she sort of knew everything about that character before they were introduced to the page, and so it seems like every detail that she gives you in the story seems absolutely right for that character. But I've never really felt that way, and that's true across the board for all my writing, the novels as well, even though I spend longer with the characters in the novel. They are, in a way, half strangers to me, and that's why I'm interested in them.
Mm.
But I do think when you're a reader, you pick up a book and a character comes onto the page and they're a stranger to you, the reader, and you get to know more about them as we journey along. That's true of people, too. I mean, we think we know people, but actually there are depths there that, you know, you'll never really understand. Occasionally you'd be really shocked by somebody that you thought you knew very well. So I always feel that there is room for not knowing characters, and in a way that's useful, and in a way it's accurate to life.
Ain't that true? That is so true. I wonder if there are little rules that you have in your mind about the short story form, like, you know, how many characters are kind of allowed on the page for a given time. You know, I think it's really easy to overpopulate a short story and, you know, have too many things going on, or try to start explaining people by, you know, backstory and pulling in more people. Is that ever a challenge, or do you kind of have rules that you go by that, you know, a lot of these characters really are alone in these stories, and that presents its own challenges too. But I'm wondering if there are kind of guidelines that you follow, you know, never more than five characters, never more than two locations, never more than five scenes.
Yeah,
No, go ahead.
I think if I do have rules, then they're in my subconscious somewhere. I have to confess to being a writer that is not terribly aware of my own process, and I'm always apologizing for this when I'm giving interviews, but I'm just not that aware of why I'm doing things usually. But I suspect that there is a frame that I'm working within, and again, you just have a sense of the right balance on the page, so things can't be overcrowded. There are characters that I'm interested in that are going to interact, and they have to be developed to a certain extent, and that feels like the right level of casting. I think I do prefer a minimal cast. Thinking back over the work, there are very, very few characters in each of the stories, and it's because I think the stories are so intimate, and particularly in this collection, you know, you get a lot of erotic scenarios in the stories too. So obviously, there's a very reduced cast, usually of two, occasionally more, but mostly two. So I think, again, the subject matter and the scenarios that these characters find themselves in will limit how many people are around. And I think it's this thing that I do of testing characters as well, setting them up in situations where they have to rely on themselves and not other people. They find themselves in a wilderness, they have to know what to do, or actually they don't know what to do, but they're just having to struggle and intuitively get on with things. And again, that's really testing their mettle rather than anyone being able to pick up the phone and get in touch with somebody else for help. It's about soul searching and resourcefulness and durability.
Yeah. My guest this morning is Sarah Hall. The book is The Beautiful Indifference. Are there characters that have called out to you for more time, you know, that we might see in a novel, or, you know, characters who you feel like you're not done with?
Usually not. I think I quite like having these fleeting love affairs with people, with characters, and catching a little bit of them and then letting them go about their own business. I don't think I've ever really written a character that I've thought, oh, I could come back to you, because I always have to feel that whatever I'm writing, it is, even if it's left unfinished dramatically, it's finished artistically, so there will be no more, there's no necessary inquiry into those characters for me, even though I don't know them fully and a situation may be left hanging in the balance. I've spent enough time with them and they've not served a purpose, but they've introduced themselves as much as they need to and shown themselves as much as they need to. And I never really do want to go back.
Let's talk.
It could be that I'm like the character in Mozambique who's having to kill off an ex-lover.
Good point, right. Let's talk about ordering the collection itself, because I know that, you know, you don't just slap the stories in. First of all, you know, I mean, choosing the seven that make it in, I'm sure, is a trial in and of itself. But ordering the collection once you have it, so that there is this progression not only within the individual stories, but a progression over the collection, I think is its own kind of art. And maybe you can talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, sure. I think what I was going for in ordering the collection was a sense of, this is going to sound very grand and grander than I probably mean it to, but these existential questions that are being asked all the way through get larger and larger and larger, you know, as you progress. So the scenarios may not seem to be in order. I mean, the love affairs, that, you know, we're not moving towards a happy ending love affair situation. And there are love affairs failing and succeeding and starting out of order in the collection. But really the sort of existential nature of it, where people are asking about what they are and who they are and why they exist and everything else, and pitting themselves against the universe or God or whatever, that is moving towards a kind of a greater scheme towards the end, so that the last story, the one set in Finland, you get a couple who they're reading a book about the end, speculative book about the end of the world, how it might happen in the next 100 years, and they encounter a small disaster of their own, or certainly the female character does, and it's pitted against this text that they're reading about plague and asteroid impact and all the things that we kind of worry in a grand existential way about finishing us off. And I think that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to open out and out and out, just a sense of, you know, who and what we are. And that sounds strange to say that I'm doing that in short stories, but it just felt that that was the general movement of the collection.
Mm-hmm.
But also, because I read this way, I read out of sync. I'll pick up a short story collection and flash through and see the titles and see the lengths, and I'll read them out of order. So I was fully expecting other people to do that with mine, and I wanted to mix things up so that were you to just dive in, it wouldn't matter. There's a sense of each story being its own thing, and you might read one because you like the title and go back and read the one just before it. They somehow work together, but they're also their own. They're also doing their own thing.
I do that same thing, and I always think the author would be so annoyed with me, because one of my questions is always, you know, ordering the collection so it's this beautiful thing in and of itself, and I never read like that. I always dive into the middle of a collection and then go back and read the first one and then the last one, and, you know,
I
never follow my own advice and read it in order, but that's okay. And endings in and of themselves, you know, I think ending a short story is very tricky. And usually the ending, I think, when I've been writing myself, is probably a page back from where it actually ended. Do you have a strong sense of ending, because they always end on, you know, a quirky note? Do you know when the ending has happened?
I think I do when I'm writing, but it's not the ending that I'm aiming for. As you say, it's something a little further back. I'm abbreviating something. So I can have written the final sentence, and I'm still slightly thinking ahead, and I'm thinking ahead to an ending that I had possibly imagined maybe only a few sentences before, and anticipating how I'll get there, and I'm not able to do it. And then I'll look down at the page, and I'll think, oh, no, I'm here. you know, that I've already arrived at the ending. Right. And I think in the short story collection, there, looking at it, I think there seem to be two types of ending that I've been using in that collection. And one is a terribly sort of agoraphobic ending where everything is opened out so much at the end of a story that, you know, you're sort of facing down a vast universe or something. But a couple of them snap shut at the end. You know, there's a sort of, there might be a little mystery, it's half solved, and the story snaps shut at the end. So I think I favour these two sort of ways of finishing. I can't, I'm not quite sure if that fits, and I certainly can't talk about the endings because that will spoil it for everyone, but
right.
I can just sense myself that I tend to lean one way or another with that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time, but I'm wondering if you have words of advice for writers.
Ooh, always tricky. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think it's really just about the integrity of what you want to write about. And you can always sort of second guess what's wanted by people and whether one style is popular or another. But I think writers really know how they're able to express themselves and what their style is and how to hone that. And that's what I would recommend, is sort of honing your style, knowing where, having people read your work and figuring out what's moving people and convincing people and where the language is working. And also just trying to be original. I mean, that's the only thing that's going to last. Are there any original stories out there? Who knows? There are really original ways of telling things. And I think if you can just find your own way, locate your own literary DNA and be proud of it and stick with it, and that might mean you're terribly unpopular for a long time, but at some point it may come around to you. I think that's all you can do. It's just about integrity.
Really well said. Really well said. Sarah Hall, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Hall. The book is The Beautiful Indifference. It's out now and available in paperback. Gorgeous collection. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Jennifer Haig will be on in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Antiter Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We are under Talk News as opposed to Public Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com or barbaradamarcobarrett.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. If you haven't checked out our speaker series events in Corona Del Mar and you live in Southern California or in Orange County, those are fantastic events. They sell out early. Another one is coming up in a month or two, so be sure and check out that online and get your tickets early. Onward with the show. We are going on with short stories today. I'm pleased to be joined now by Jennifer Haig. Jennifer is a novelist and short story writer. She has published four novels, including Faith and the Condition. Her first book, Mrs. Kimball, won the 2004 Penn Hemingway Award for debut fiction. Her second, Baker Towers, was a New York Times bestseller and won the 2006 Penn LL Winship Award for Outstanding Book by a New England author. Both have been published in nine languages. Other fiction has been published in Granta, Plowshares, Good Housekeeping, other places. She was born and raised in Western Pennsylvania. She's a graduate of Dickinson College in the Iowa Writers Workshop. Her latest is a collection of interlinked short stories entitled News from Heaven. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our discussion this morning. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on. I want to talk first about your decision to play with the short story form after writing a number of novels. What drew you to the short story genre? What made you make that switch? Perhaps you haven't actually made the switch. But
well, you know, I was a short story writer long before I was a novelist. My first attempts at writing fiction were all stories. So this has been my first love as a writer. It is the first book of stories I've published, even though I've published many of them individually in journals and magazines. I suppose the attraction really is that writing short stories allows you to write the emotional crescendos, the sort of the moments of lyricism and beauty and heightened intensity. You get to do that too in a novel, but you have to do an awful lot of groundwork first. The writer Jim Shepherd says that he prefers writing short stories because when you write a novel, you're moving around a lot of furniture. And that is very much my feeling about it. You know, you need several chapters to sort of orient the reader and give the lay of the land and create the landscape and fill in everybody's backstories. And it is a very arduous process. A short story, it's quite a different thing. You know, you're choosing your moment differently. You basically begin the story a minute before it ends.
Yeah, right. I was just listening to an interview with George Saunders, who was talking about, you know, I know what a beautiful 8 or 10 or 20 pages looks like, but, you know, it's difficult to sustain that intensity and to sustain that beauty over 300 pages, right?
Yes.
Really good point. You know, the nice thing about interlinked short stories, of course, is that in some respects, I suppose you don't have to choose. You know, a lot of their characters get their own backstory by having their own story.
It's true. It lets you do a bit of both. And this book, News from Heaven, is a particularly good example of this because, in fact, it picks up the story of a few characters from my second novel, Baker Towers. Yeah. So those characters I did not need to build from scratch. They were already alive in my imagination. And though I hadn't written about them for a number of years, it was a great pleasure to go back to them.
I was just chatting about this in the first half hour with Sarah Hall about how much is known about characters in short stories that never makes it onto the page, how much the author, you know, realizes about these characters' backstories and where they came from and what motivates them that we, the reader, do not get to see.
Right. Most of it, in fact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about what what begins each story for you? It sounds like a lot of it is character, but I'm wondering, is it a moment that these characters are experiencing? Well, you know, kind of what's your, what's the juice that feeds you? Is it their plot experience? Is it character themselves? Is it, you know, something that happened that you read about in the newspaper that sort of inspires a plot element?
You know, you're right. Character is usually the first thing that comes to me. I suppose I'm drawn to a moment when a character is in extremis. You know, it's the moment after which nothing will ever be the same. And I think that is always a great occasion for a short story. It's an episode or an experience or a movement in a person's life that changes everything.
Mm-hmm. And do you know that moment before you sit down to write it? Or is that something you discover along the way?
It happens both ways. In a short story, I feel much more comfortable blundering my way through and sort of putting the characters on stage and letting them talk to each other and see what happens. With a novel, you do that at your peril. You know, it's like setting off on a cross-country trip and not having a map with you and just sort of trusting that you're going to get there. A lot can go wrong. But with a short story, you know, it's a smaller investment of time, and there are fewer pages in which you can trip yourself up.
Yeah. We were talking about this also earlier, about whether your first draft of a short story closely resembles the last draft of the short story. If you know it when you see it, if it's going to work or not, and you discard it early on, or if you keep working through draft after draft to kind of change it into what it needs to be.
Well, you know, once in a while, one does come easily to me, but that is the exception. More often, I agonize over these things. You know, I feel that there is a hierarchy of literary forms, sort of a pyramid, and I put poetry at the top, being the least forgiving of all the forms. When you're writing a poem, if you get one word wrong, you pretty much blew it.
Yep.
You know, at the bottom of the pyramid is the novel, where you can get a whole chapter wrong, and if it's interesting enough, the reader will probably hang in there with you and exercise some patience. The short story falls kind of in the middle, where, you know, there's a little bit of room for error. You can maybe get a whole paragraph wrong, and you know, the thing can still work. So, you know, I feel a bit looser in the way I approach them. That said, there are a couple stories in this new collection that took a very, very long time to figure out. The first story in the book is called Beast and Bird, and I know because I still have the file on my computer where I started writing it. I created that file in 2004, and I finished the story in 2006. So, you know, it was really, I wrote two novels in the time I was still ruminating over this story, trying to make sense of it. So there are quite a few instances where I've had to exercise a lot of patience and really go back to the story again and again and again and sort of troubleshoot what's wrong with it.
What was it in that story that you knew there was something there?
Well, the situation was compelling to me. Beast and Bird is set in 1934. It's a story of a small town girl from this little coal mining town in Pennsylvania who is hired to be a housemaid for a wealthy Orthodox Jewish family in New York City. And when she first arrives in this home, she has no idea that there's a reason for all the complicated rules of how to prepare food in the kitchen, that, in fact, her employer is keeping a kosher kitchen. She's never heard of such a thing. So I like those fish-out-of-water stories where you have a girl who has never ridden in a car before is being met in a taxi cab at the train station. That was very interesting to me.
Yep. My guest this morning is Jennifer Haig. The book is News from Heaven. You know, I didn't really give you a chance to introduce the collection itself, and I want to give you an opportunity to do that, because the landscape, what this is set around, the mining town, is as much a character in these stories as anybody else is. So go ahead and introduce kind of the collection, what inspired it, kind of what it's centered around.
Sure. News from Heaven is a collection of 10 stories that all revolve around this little coal mining town in western Pennsylvania I call Bakerton. The stories stretch from the 1930s to the present day, so it's about a 70-year span, I guess. what you see essentially is the life cycle of this coal town, the sort of movement from boom town to bust. And it's similar subject matter to my second novel, Baker Towers, the difference being that this short story form gives me the freedom to look at how a number of different people experience this town and the trajectories of their lives and you know, what happens to the people who stay and also what happens to the people who leave. And you see a lot of that in this collection. It's really about the pull that home exerts on all of us emotionally and psychologically.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a story that is set in Vegas, and Pennsylvania is just as alive in that story, I would say, in such an overwhelming town as Vegas, as it is, you know, the stories that are actually set in Pennsylvania. I thought that was really telling, actually.
That was absolutely my intention. The character in the Las Vegas story will be familiar to people who've read Baker Towers. He was the sort of enigmatic younger brother in the Novak family who skips town when he's 18 years old and is not seen again for many years, and the reader sort of never knows what became of him. In these stories, you get the answer to that question. You see how Sandy's life turned out.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me about knowing when a story is going to, you know, I always think of short stories as having kind of this magic moment, and if that's a sense that you have as writer, if that's something that has been cultivated over time and the process of writing, if that's something that's innate when you know that moment in a short story has happened, or if it still is difficult for you sometimes to recognize whether it's there or not.
I can usually recognize it. And for me, it's generally the moment where the story starts to surprise me, where I go into it with an idea of what the story's about and who the characters are. And when I make a discovery that is startling to me, I have the sense that this thing is alive and I'm not just trying to animate a lifeless thing, but that it's got some sort of organic life of its own.
Yeah. Likewise with the endings, you know, knowing when the ending has happened in a short story, I think is more difficult than knowing when an ending has happened in a novel. And do you know when that, do you know when the ending has happened?
God, it's desperately difficult for me in both forms. I have to say, I live in terror of getting the ending wrong in anything I write. Because we've all had this experience as readers where, you know, you're completely seduced by a novel, you're enjoying the whole ride, and the ending is so wrong that it makes you want to throw the book across the room, and you remember it forever as the book with the terrible ending, not the book with the great opening chapter.
Right, right. So true. I guess, you know, to dovetail on that, the ordering of the collection itself, I know, is never, you know, happenstance, right? All the stories have to be in dialogue with each other as well as standing up on their own and, you know, creating that great arc over the course of the collection. Talk a little bit about that, your decision to how to order these stories, how you feel like they're in dialogue with each other. They're a little more so because they're interconnected and characters keep popping back up, but...
Well, you know, it was the first time I'd done this. I haven't had a collection before. So I'm used to thinking of stories as discrete things that exist all on their own. And in fact, 9 of these 10 stories have already been published in journals or magazines and did have a life all on their own. And I was sort of surprised to discover that they became a very different thing when you place them side by side. So the order does matter a lot. One of the things I liked about composing this collection and deciding on the order of the stories is that there are sort of several different families of characters that you encounter through the course of the book. And so, you know, there might be a story that concerns the Novak family in position 5. In fact, there is. Position 4 and 5 are both Novak stories. And then you get another Novak story in position 8. You know, so it's you pick up a thread and then you put it back down and pick up another thread. And it's kind of a process of weaving in a certain way.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. My guest this morning is Jennifer Haig. The book is News from Heaven. And I also am, you know, because so many of these characters came out of a novel from you and you felt like you weren't done with them yet, I'm wondering if if that is still your experience, if there are still characters out there that are the kind of knocking on your psychological door and wanting more time on the stage, do you feel like you're done with these people, or do you feel like there are still some unfinished business after this collection?
You know, your guess is as good as mine. I thought I was done with them the last time when I finished writing Baker Towers in 2004. I really thought that was all I had to say about this part of the world. Because, as you say, the town of Bakerton is sort of the main character, both in the novel and in these stories. And I thought I had said it all before, and as it turns out, I was wrong. So it's entirely possible that I will revisit this landscape at some point in the future. I just don't know.
I always think it's interesting that so many writers write about the places where they grew up, and that sense of place when you're little seems so more visceral than any place you'd live as an adult, you know, and it just feels like there's some emotional tug of the places where we had those early formative years that draws authors back and draws writers back. Do you feel like that's your experience, that there was something kind of visceral that happened to you in those years, that if you had moved to Pennsylvania as an adult, the experience wouldn't be quite as intense?
There is some truth to that. I think I might still have chosen to write about this place. It is a very compelling place, but I would have written very different things. And, you know, I think that as writers, there's one story that's given to us, and that's the story that kind of grows out of our childhood, our early life. And then there are many other stories to tell, too, and you approach them with a different set of eyes, really. So, you know, what you may lose in a certain kind of visceral attachment, you may gain in humor or, perceptiveness. So, you know, about half my work involves Pennsylvania, and about half of it involves Boston, where I live now. And I adore writing about Boston, and I think I'll continue to write about Boston for a long time. But I don't do it in quite the same way. It maybe is less blind and instinctual, and more based on concrete observation rather than just feeling. My last novel, Faith, is set in Boston, as was the one before that. So it seems to me that I'm going to be weaving those two subjects together now for a little while, going back and forth between the two.
Is the experience of living away from the place make it easier to write about, do you think? I mean, do you feel like you need that distance?
I think it does. It does for me, anyway. I don't know that if I had never left that place, I don't think I could see it clearly enough to write about it.
Yeah, right. That's always the question, is whether you need a little bit of distance from something to sort of accurately assess it, or I don't know. But very interesting. I lost my train of thought on what I wanted to jump to next, which happens more and more, I have to tell you, in later age. I also am curious about how much these stories finished and in the aftermath come back to you, if you read them with a different eye than you did when you were writing them, now that they're kind of out in the world, you're talking about them, you're hearing readers' perceptions of them. Do you see things in the stories now that it's being kind of digested by third parties that you didn't see when you were writing them?
Yes, I do. In fact, I had a moment like that the other day. There was a lovely review of the collection in the Kansas City Star. And the reviewer, I thought, said something very smart. She talked about this hotel in the town of Bakerton called the Commercial Hotel that appears in a number of these stories. And like the town itself, the Commercial Hotel, you know, has good times and bad times. In fact, it burns to the ground at one point and is then rebuilt and is given the same name as the old hotel. And she really saw that as a kind of a fitting metaphor for the town itself and for the whole collection. And I had never thought about that in any conscious way when I was writing it, but, you know, I think she's right.
Yeah, yeah. You had talked about the first story as being challenging, or at least, you know, taking perhaps the longest to write and grappling with it. I'm wondering what the other real difficulties were that came out of this collection, and kind of how you wrestled them to the ground. What presented the biggest challenges to you, and how did you fight the demons?
You know, the other story that gave me fits was the penultimate story. It's called What Remains. It's a story that held up the collection for literally for years as I was trying to finish it. I could very easily have gone out with just 9 stories in the collection. It would have been fine. But I couldn't do that. I felt that there was some piece of the story of Bakerton that would not be communicated unless I got this last story right. And so I went back and forth on it. And at one point it was a novella. It was a much longer story and ended up sort of being distilled down and down and down into the size that it is now. Part of what was difficult about it is that it's the only of the stories that looks at the Baker family, who were the family that owned the coal mines for which the town is named. It's the only time I've really written about the Bakers at any length, and I think it's part of the story of this town that you need to know what happened to them, too. Mm-hmm. And so I grappled with that for a very long time, really close to 3 years, I would say. Mm-hmm. Had I given up on that story, I probably would have delivered the collection much sooner.
It's interesting that, you know, it sounds like these stories are as arduous as the novels were for you, you know, in terms of time.
Yes, they are. Absolutely. In a different way. Part of it has to do with that feeling of their fragility. You know, this is an unforgiving form. You can't afford to digress. You can't afford to take a wrong turn. So that's certainly part of it. Part of it, though, is that I love revising, and there's something about working in the short form that makes you revise very intently on a sentence level.
Yeah.
So I spent a really long time playing with the music of these sentences and sort of putting in commas and taking them back out again. It's really my favorite part of the writing process. I've always felt that there are two kinds of writers, those who love to compose and those who only like to revise. And I'm certainly the latter type. The first draft of anything is torturous to me, and I've often felt that it would be great if I could get someone to write these first drafts and then I could just fix them for a couple of years.
How many revisions would you say that a story goes through from beginning to end on average?
It varies quite a bit. And, you know, it's the notion of a draft has become a little hazier now that everybody works on computers. So, you know, what constitutes a separate draft, or are you just simply always tinkering with it every single day? I would say I've never done fewer than three drafts of a story. But, you know, I've done 9 or 10 drafts of a story as well. And some of those stories never did work. The ones I did 9 or 10 drafts of, I just ended up throwing them away in disgust. But, you know, that's part of how you teach yourself how to do it.
Yeah, right. And do you feel like you know when it's done, or would you pick up this published manuscript now and with your red pen and keep going?
Well, these feel very done to me.
Right.
But, you know, it's a book that I worked on for almost 10 years, so it would be pretty bad if I didn't have a feeling of completion by this point. I do reach a point of satisfaction with my work. I have with all of it, with the novels as well. For some reason, it's harder for me to get there with a story collection, simply because a story collection has so many moving parts. It's 10 separate things.
Right.
And a novel's only one thing. It's a big thing, but it's only one. So it's easier for me to declare that one thing finished than to look at a collection and say all 10 of these things are finished. It's more decision-making in a way, and I'm a terrible decision-maker.
Yeah, I mean, I think titles and endings are hard, and, you know, if you have to have 10 titles and 10 endings as opposed to just the one, it's a challenge.
True. Right? It's so true. Those are really the most anxious parts of the writing process for me.
Yeah, no kidding. Jennifer, we're out of time, but I so appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. That was Jennifer Haig. The collection is News from Heaven. It is out and available now. It is a great read. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for joining us. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day. Girl.